See, I've already had my AA meeting because I've spent the afternoon with our speaker, some of the afternoon with our speaker, and with some other committee members. And I would like to thank the committee for asking me to chair this meeting tonight. And those of you who go to meetings with me know that I've always got a little story or an anecdote to tell. And, you know, Clancy's never heard my story, so I thought I would tell my story tonight and let him listen. But I don't think that those of you who came tonight would appreciate that. This is not Clancy's first trip to Marietta, however. He's been here before. In fact, at the New Hope anniversary, the 10th anniversary of the New Hope, he was a speaker. And I was asked to go to the airport to pick him up. And so I said, okay, well, I better listen to some tapes and figure out what this man is all about. And a lot of people in this area have Clancy tapes. And I listened to him, and something that stuck out particularly was how he felt about people who are less than 5 years sober. And those of you who have heard that know what I'm talking about. I'll give you an idea. Just trusting their decision-making abilities was something he didn't have a whole lot of faith in. So I said, well, what I need to do is grab somebody to go with me. And I did. And Tanya and I went off to the airport to pick up Clancy. And he was the first one off the airplane. We got in the car and sped around 285. And as we came around the perimeter, just cut on 75 to drop him off at the hotel, I noticed that he was hunkered down in the front seat, strapped in the seatbelt, and holding onto that handrest up there. And he turned and he said, and by the way, girls, how long have you been sober? And we both said, a year and a half. And the look on his face was horrifying. I'm happy to say that we got him to the meeting on time, and I was able to do that again today, and I had a wonderful afternoon with him today. More importantly, none of the three of us have had a drink since that time. Please welcome back to Marietta from Venice, California, Clancy I.
My name is Clancy Imelsland, and I'm an alcoholic. Certainly glad to be here to hear the story of all her driving experiences. I want to commend Carol, though I must say, today she was flawless. She was at the plane when I got off the plane, which sometimes they're not. She was illegally parked outside the door at a curb. We jumped in her car. She shot through that traffic like a rocket. And I was in that hotel in no time, and she really did a good job. And I want to thank her. Next time, bring somebody to carry my bags. I thought that would look kind of bad to say, hey, babe, carry them bags. But I'm glad to be back in Marietta, see some old friends, see Bill C. and his group of Fench sitters from Dunwoody, and see Marcia and her brood of newcomers, and a lot of people here. Ali used to be in our group, but also a lot of old friends that I've known over the years. And it's always a pleasure to be at something. I'll tell you something. Tonight they introduced Pat W. He suddenly must have got a rash of humility. He didn't stand up. Usually you come right down front and sell you peanuts. But in 1960 or 61, I went to Las Vegas to talk when they started a meeting up there. And there was this sweaty guy just on the run from Peoria, Illinois. And his name was Pat Wheeler. And he was being helped by a guy sponsored named Tom O'Neill, and then he and his wife eventually went back to Peoria, and that was the end of it. But 2 or 3 years later, I was in Chicago on a doing some work for a company. I was working for a big toy company then. Last time I was really happy, and I tell you, You don't know the pleasure of being able to walk through the... I was advertising director for a firm called Revell, and walk through there and say, hey, get those boxes out, get these model planes ready, I want these paintings done, and I want this all ready to go. Then go to my office and shut that door and take one of our little planes and go... Well, I haven't had a happy childhood, but it's been a long one. It just was. But I was in Chicago, and I got a call from Pat W., and he said they had a little meeting in some little town, I forget the name of it, but could I come down there? And they came up and picked me up in the middle of the wintertime, cold, and he had a bunch of two or three losers in this old car. And when we got down there, I talked to this group. It was like talking to a painting, you know, just... But afterwards, Pat says, we got this guy that's slipping a lot. Nobody can keep him sober. Will you give him a shot? And I said, you bet I will. And he introduced me to this man named Tony, who was one of your trustees. I want to tell you a touching and beautiful story. It makes me choke up. I took Tony aside, and I've always been a sponsor of people who, many of the people I've sponsored have been hopeless cases. People give up on them, they send them to me, so on. Not that I'm so wonderful, but to get them off their hands. But I sat down with Tony, and I talked to him, and I talked about the problem of being a slipper, and I was a slipper for a long time, and how bad it was. I finally, as a kind of a coup d'etat, I took out a lighter out of my pocket. I said, Tony, I've carried this lighter in my pocket for 3 years. It's full of serenity and it's full of hope. I want you to hang on to that lighter. Whenever you feel like drinking, remember there's that lighter is for me, to Chuck Chamberlain, to Bill Wilson's. And he had tears in his eyes. I'll tell you something beautiful. After I left there, he went almost 4 days before he got drunk. And then he lost my damn lighter. That's the kind of men you have trustees of your Roundup. But I'm glad to be here. I've been trying to choke back my... Suffer the little children to come unto me. I'll make them suffer. Hey, I feel... I've been trying to choke back my sadness. They gave me this copy of the program, and it really makes me feel like a failure, you know. I was thinking, you know, I'm the managing director of a Skid Row mission, and I'd hoped they'd be able to put that in front of my name. They have a judge there, and I thought, managing director of a Skid Row mission, Clancy I, but they wouldn't do it. Then Sunday morning speaker, M.A. Barnes, I thought they could put Clancy Immersland. But I guess they didn't know how to spell Immersland. Alan on speaker's last name. I'll tell you, this was a touching and beautiful program. I have an idea for your program next year, your motto called Read the Traditions. I shouldn't have said anything until I got reimbursed for that damn ticket. But I'm not really being mean. I've already cornered Russ and made him cry, so it's all right. But we don't put the last names on programs, and we don't, as a rule. George, I guess it's all right where most of the people can't read it. Nothing. I didn't mean you. I meant those people on this side of the post that can't hear me. But I used to drink. I want to work that in before I sit down. I used to. Incidentally, I would tell you that you'll have some good speakers for this weekend. I know you'll enjoy them. Yeah, but I used to drink, and I drank for many years, and I didn't... I've heard many people in AA talk about how they always fought for their right to drink, and they were consumed with their efforts to make sure they could drink. I never thought about drinking in that way at all. Drinking was... never an obsession with me as far as I could tell, never something that was on my mind a lot. Drinking was a therapeutic, but it was not something I spent a lot of time thinking about. My problems seemed to be much more complex and different than that. As long as I could... Is someone laughing down there? Wait till I get to the part where I get leukemia. You like that? And I died, too. But well, you're Miss Barnes, aren't you? Let me see. I gotta stop being mean. I gotta be. But I've, most of my life, I've fought emotions, fought feelings, fought conflicts, fought things. I didn't have, always have a term for them. And as I've been talking a little bit about recently, some of the people were here, they were in the audience when I talked in Jekyll Island 3 or 4 weeks ago, and so they're going to get dull because I'm going to talk basically the same thing because it's basically the same approach. But most of my life, I have seemed to me had a tangled with emotions. And over the years, I've just talked about emotions. I've talked about fear. I've talked about loneliness. And I've talked about feelings of rejection and all sorts of things. But to kind of keep from getting an hour and a half on emotions, I suppose I could center them probably in three general areas that the other three fit into, the other emotions fit into. One, and probably the most long-term pervading emotion of my life is something I didn't recognize until I was sober for some time. And I still have it from time to time when I'm weak and heavy laden. All the emotions I talk about, I want you to know if you're new, you don't get rid of them. You just get them controllable and they don't come very often. But one of the great emotions of my life was that for some reason I could not understand, and I did not identify this emotion, but I felt it and later saw it. For some reason I could not understand, I am not quite enough. I don't know why I'm not quite enough or in what way I'm not quite enough, but other people seem to be able to see it and treat me as though I'm not quite enough. It's as though they recognize something in me. Nothing overt, but they're just a little bit of a, he's not enough. And so as a result of that, you go through life having to find an edge, something extra, some dog and pony show that to get that extra. Because of myself, I know that I won't be enough. I don't know why they always seem to like each other better than they like me. They don't actually say so, but I can tell it. I don't know why that sooner or later I can feel the little coldness. A few years ago, I was at a meeting in Pacific Palisades, and I was the second speaker, and the first speaker was a big dummy, and he could barely talk, and I thought, geez, what a long-winded talk. He's using up all of his time. And I was kind of dozing off, and I heard him say something that reached out and caught my throat because it's the story of my life. He said, all of my life, it seems like people somehow act like there's something different about me, but nobody ever tells me what it is. And boy, I recognize that feeling a little bit. And there's a corresponding or corollary to this that comes. And again, I recognized this long after I was sober, but I went through much of my life with it and still do from time to time when I'm weak or heavy laden. And that is this. When you're not feeling like you're quite enough, although you don't consciously think of it that way, one of the symptoms is I insist people treat me special. Because if you treat me special, I'll feel average. If you treat me average, I'll feel rejected. And I'll tell you, there's no place in the world where they're going to treat you special all the time. Nobody. And so eventually you always start to feel rejected, and yeah, I've got to go on to the next whatever it may be. But that feeling of not being quite enough has always been a problem to me. Another problem that seemed to be an intermittent problem to me a lot in my life, I seem to be extremely susceptible to fear. Cold fear. Now, I know that everybody gets afraid, but they say, well, I was kind of down and out. I'd lost everything. I was so afraid. My fear seems to come when I become successful. And I start to get it all together. It's as though I'm not quite able to do it, but I'm fooling them. And what brings that fear about is when someone criticizes me. Someone makes some real criticism. And years later, I begin to understand why. Because when you don't feel like you're quite enough, it's almost as though they've found me out. They've caught me. And my instant reaction, my fear, is to try to demolish them. Not with a gun, but with memos and nasty talk and undercutting them. If you criticize me, I'll get you. And eventually you always lose when you're in that situation. But it always comes when I'm feeling successful and insecure. It always did. The last feeling I had most of my life that brought about a lot of other feelings is that, you know, it's hard to remember this, but we always talk in life about there are bullets that have people's name on them. Well, there's no use trying to dodge that bullet that had my name, or dodge the arrow that has your name on it. But there's a lot of arrows out there that are just addressed to whom they may concern. You know. Boom. Boom. And so all of us have been given light coats of armor, and you go through life and you're ping, 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 ping. It's no big deal. But it seemed to me much of my life my armor has been stuck open. Just and boom, boom, boom. People say, oh, it's no big deal. It just bounced right off of me. Ping.
Well, it's a big deal to me, God damn it.
Always overreacting and feeling things so strongly. And as a result of that, I mean, those were just some of them, other things, and they weren't there all the time. But if you're like me, you notice when you have a lot of emotional problems, they're like being in the middle of a bubbling pot, you know. It's always something, for Christ's sake. And there's only really one bad time, and that's when nothing's going on, because you know something bad is, but you don't know what it is. You notice that in newcomers a lot. I have nothing against newcomers. Some of my best friends were newcomers once. I wouldn't want my daughter to marry one. But she did. I've said this before, but if you ever wanted textbook definition of mixed emotions, it's watching your youngest daughter go down the aisle with the guy whose fifth step you've heard. They showed Father of the Bride today on their plane. I didn't even watch it. That's a snap, you know. You can't really say anything. You can give little signals, I guess. Let me know if he ever brings a sheep home, honey. I knew they were serious because he'd start picking her up and he'd take her to dinner. She's not an alcoholic. She wasn't then. And she caught it later. But he'd take her to dinner, and he'd tell her about AA, and he'd take her to a movie, and he'd talk about AA, and he'd take her out to his ice cream after the meeting, and talk about AA. And he'd take her home, and that was the big point. When he, instead of kissing her goodnight, he led her in the Lord's Prayer. I like that. I think that's pretty good. I'll write that right under the delegate's phone number here. But I always seem to be battling some kind of emotions and feelings. But the one thing I thought was a compensating device was that I always seemed to have a great deal of ambition. I always wanted very much to be something. And that pulled me through a lot. I want to be something. And when I see guys come that I work with now, new guys, and they talk about, people say, boy, that guy's got a lot of ambition. And you talk to him, and sometimes I think, uh-oh, he's got the kind of ambition that I got. And that is not ambition. And he's going to be a long, hard job getting this guy straight. Because what looks like ambition is not really ambition. It's a drive to, I don't feel like I'm enough, so I'm going to get more things and show you. Got nothing to do with ambition. It's showing them. And you never realize it, but there is never enough. You can get something, and as soon as you get used to it, it's nothing anymore. You got to get something else. There's, that particular form of ambition makes you crazy. But I thought it was healthy at the time. I had ambition. I did a lot of things. And I, when I was a young man struggling to become something, I, having some difficulties, I went to psychoanalysis. That's what they did in those days. I guess they do now. Today's psychoanalysis isn't the same anymore. So many little people have been in it. But in my day, just the thinkers and sensitive seekers were there. And I discovered some things that would just bring tears down your cheeks. I discovered how I'd been hurt and how these emotions came about. It wasn't just coincidence. For example, I had been psychologically scarred by the Norwegian Lutheran Church. Now, you don't have much of it down here, but up in northern Wisconsin where I grew up, the Norwegian Lutheran Church is the big church. You're in the majority. People with black hair, watch out. You know, they're all brown hair or blondes, and we all stand around. And they only have two rules. You don't sin, and you don't monkey with Catholics. Pretty much it. And unfortunately for me, I was weak. I sinned, and later on I monkeyed with Catholics. And eventually I sinned with Catholics. Eventually I repopulated the Catholic Church, I'll tell you that. But I knew I was kind of going to hell probably, but I tried to develop a working atheism. You know, the kind of atheism where you stand around and say, there is no God. If there's a God, let him strike me dead. But in psychoanalysis, I discovered that that church had psychologically scarred me. It had repressed me terribly. I used to think about that. I always liked that church, even when I was going to hell. And now I discover that they have screwed up my life. If I knew then what I know now, I would have formed adult children of Norwegian Lutherans. Could have hired a couple codependents and sat around and been pissed off every week. And yet psychoanalysis made me feel better. I discovered a lot of things. I discovered I'd been deprived as a child. I'd been raised in the Depression and been scarred. I didn't even know there'd been a Depression. But when I found out, I realized I'd been screwed there, too. I've been screwed a lot. Now, you may wonder, why would people... I'll tell you what happens to you in psychoanalysis. You begin to understand the nature of your own victimization. And there's a number of therapies today who preach victimization. Whether the victimization is by abstract people, by your parents and how much they drank, or there's all kinds of victimization. And you wonder, why would people get caught up into wanting to get into a program and staying on a program where they are victimized, it points out they are victims? And it took me a long time before that fell together in my head. And I think, in my opinion, it's just this. Over the years, I've maybe listened to 200 and some inventories, and there are very few things all alcoholics have in common, but a couple of things is Every alcoholic I have known at depth has always had a come here, at least, with a lack of self-worth, however they disguise it. Another aspect is deep-seated guilt. Guilt of, because there's a kind of a Puritan streak in alcoholics, of all things, these libertines, there's a streak of Puritanism, and it brings about guilt. Now there's, and these emotions are not emotions that go away quickly. They require a lot of work over a period of time. They require a lot of work and a lot of steps and a lot of surrender and all sorts of things. Now, what would you think? We don't know, can't do much about the lack of self-worth. But what would you do if I told you I could help you to get rid of guilt just like that? Nobody in the world can tell you how to get rid of guilt, but I can tell you how to get rid of guilt just like that. Go to a program where it proves that you are a victim. Because I'll tell you a very interesting thing. When it's their fault, it is no longer my fault. When it is their fault, when they have done it to me, I am not responsible. I am just acting out bad things that they instilled within me years ago. There's a great relief come to that. The guilt is gone. My God, it's wonderful. But there's one bad thing that comes with it, as there always is. There's never any free lunch. The bad thing is this. There's a price tag that is not obvious nor apparent. It comes little by little over a long period of time. In order to prove that they are at fault and to sustain that belief, which keeps me relatively guilt-free, I must continue and enhance my feelings of resentment towards them. I must continue and enhance my feelings of self-pity because this has been done to me. I must continue and enhance my feelings of being different because it is not my fault. I've been made different. And there's one thing you learn in this book and this fellowship. Of all the emotions that we are prey to that are most painful, resentment, self-pity, and feelings of difference. But you don't know about that. All you know is, I found freedom because I found it's their fault. But if you ever see people in these fellowships, I'm not putting down their fellowship at all because they can do what they want to. But in their fellowships, nobody ever smiles. Because they're there to intensify the resentment. Because that's what holds off the guilt. But I want to hesitate to say, I have no objections to any program anywhere. Any feeling like this at all. I'm glad to see all meetings of inner child, transactional analysis called inner child, or adult children of alcoholics. All these things are fine. But I think you and I must make it incumbent upon ourselves to make sure they don't bring that crap into our AA meetings. I don't go to adult child meetings and insist that they make amends or that they work the steps. I don't want them sitting in our meeting, newcomers who don't even know their way out of the parking lot yet, explaining to me their dysfunctional situations and why this can't possibly help. The best example I know of that is my father. My father was a strong personality, kind of dominated my life, and I was his only child for many years. And he was a strong guy and a talented guy and witty and clever, and he was kind of the Mr. Chips of Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Everyone went to school there, had him for a teacher, and they all loved him. But as I got older and started screwing up, he became more and more unhappy with me. And I became more and more unhappy with him because it seemed to me when I needed him, the time I needed him the most is when he wasn't there. And we had developed, I really got to be kind of resentful. Then he divorced He and my mother divorced in the first divorce I'd ever seen. Now, that's how things were different before the Second World War. And he married another woman, and I hated her, and then I hated him more. And over the years, my mother got remarried to some guy, and I hated him. And it was just hideous. When I had a long-term resentment towards my father. Then I got married, had a couple children. One morning I was in jail again, just some dumb thing, drunk, and got in a fight with some guy, turned out to be a plainclothes cop of all things. And he came down to my jail cell at 6 in the morning. He'd never done that. He always felt so bad about my problems. But he came down to my jail cell. I thought, well, maybe he's going to come down and give me some support now for once, for God's sakes, and I'll do something about it. And he came down and he said, well, did you have a good time last night while you're out drunk? I said, no, I didn't, Dad. It really was a dumb thing. I didn't mean to get into this. I've gotten a beef. It's just stupid. It won't happen again. He says, I hope you had a good time, because while you're out drunk, you let your little son die. I don't ever want to see you again. And he walked out, and all I could think of to holler, I didn't mean to! Not much of an answer. And I hated him all the more. It just seemed to me he just came down there perfectly to turn the knife at me. And I saw him again, of course, at the funeral 2 or 3 days later. He was pleasant, and I was pleasant, but I thought, what kind of a father are you? And pretty shortly after that, I stopped talking to him. And I didn't talk to him for years. To me, he was the epitome of what I should have been, and he screwed it up. I got sober finally. I was about sober about 8 months. I'd been slipping for years, but this time I stayed sober 8 months, and I fell in the hands of some fanatic AA sponsor. And he says, now today we're going to start working on our amends. I said, okay. He says, we're going to... I want you to start with the most important one. I want you to write a letter of amends to your father. And I said, you got to be kidding, Bob. Where's the letter of amends he sends to me? You know, he ruined my life, and he ruined my mother's life, and he ruined everybody's life. And by God, he better write a letter of amends to me. He said, we don't care what kind of a father he was. That's something for him to do work with. We're concerned with what kind of a son you were. You were kind of a crappy son. And you're going to write a letter. And I thought, I am not. He said, yes, you are. And I want to see it before you send it. That's a nasty little thing. And I brought him this letter finally. And he said, no. He said, not to attack him, to make amends. And he made 2 or 3 versions before we finally sent one. And I felt ashamed of sending that letter. Then at Christmas, he wanted me to send him a Christmas card, as well as my mother. I didn't mind sending my mother one, as long as I didn't have to address it to her husband, too. And then it was birthday, and on, this went on and on. I just hated it. But he sent me little notes, glad you're doing fine, son. If there's anything I can do to help you, let me know. I said, yeah, you bet. If there's nothing you can do, maybe you can ruin my life some more. When I was about three or four years sober, I was up in Minneapolis from Los Angeles, and job I was working on, and I went down to Eau Claire, Wisconsin for the first time to see my mother. And I had promised some people in Los Angeles I would go over and see my father. And when I got there, I saw my mother, and it was fine, but I started going to my father. It's just like going to hell. I got on the porch, I almost didn't ring the doorbell, and then I rang the doorbell. I didn't want to, this big, overpowering, intimidating guy's going to ruin my life some more. And the door opened, and some short little gray-haired guy was there, meek. And he had shrunk a lot since I remembered it, but he still was not a likable. He said, oh, I'm glad to see your son come in. I said, is your wife home? She said, no, she's not here. I said, okay. I went and we sat down. I felt uncomfortable. It was like, I don't know how to explain it, but I just felt uncomfortable. I wanted to get out of there. And I wrote him a couple of notes after that, and he read to me, and I sent him notes and Christmas cards and Christmas presents. I went up there a year or so later, and I saw him again, and it wasn't quite so bad. When I was about 5 years sober, my wife and children, who had been living in Dallas, moved to California finally, And they just got there about 2 weeks. They were there trying to get used to, God, all of a sudden going from bachelor life to a house full of kids and dogs and yammering and screaming. And they couldn't get any sympathy because they got all the sympathy because I've been alone or something. I've lost my family. Now they all came back and said, well, I suppose you're happy now. Shit, no. You know. But anyway, I got a call from my father. His wife had suddenly died. Could I please find my way clear to come up and help him through this? And I said, okay. And so I went up there and I got up to shoot. One night, we were talking about the car earlier today. One night we were sitting up, we sat up all night. And somehow we got talking, and he got talking about how my childhood had looked to him. And I couldn't believe my ears. It looked to him entirely different. To him, he had scrimped and saved and gone without so I would have things and I could go to school and have a bicycle when he couldn't even afford hardly to put food on the table. He saw that I had a bicycle and on and on. And I'll tell you, it brought tears to my eyes before morning because it was an entirely different version than I had in my mind. So after that, we were a little more friendly. And the nice part about it is, for the next 20 years, we got progressively more close. I say we spent 20 years probably as more closely father and son than most fathers and sons ever achieve in their life. And we got old and feeble. He moved out to our house in Los Angeles. And he spent his declining years there and got to be kind of a favorite of many of the A's because he had a worse collection of jokes than I did. And then he got old and feeble and wanted like an old elephant to get back to the elephant burial grounds. He said, well, I'm going home, son. He went back to Eau Claire and he died up there. And he clutched my hand and died, and I clutched his hand. And a couple of days later, I sat in the Norwegian Lutheran Church next to his little casket. And I was looking around thinking, God, isn't that remarkable? I never thought I'd be in this church. Now I'm here. I'm glad my dad is dead because he'd been sick and he's free of his pain. And this church that once upon a time I would have sworn I'd never go in, I now look around it and think to myself, God, I'm glad someone finally taught me that the same God is in this church as is in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, as is in my meeting in West L.A. That's a loving God. And most of the people in that church will never know it. They sit in fear because God is a fearful thing. I'm so glad I had to go through what I had to go through to learn that. But the moral of this story is this. If I had done what was intellectually correct, that old man would have died without me ever talking to him. And to this day, when people mention his name, my gut would grind. I think, that old son of a bitch ruined my life. And instead, with the actions that AA talks about, it's a slow process. It isn't fast like getting rid of your guilt. But you pay as you go. There's no attendant growing resentment and self-pity and feelings of difference. But at that time, I didn't know that. I was in psychoanalysis looking for reasons to feel victimized, and I found them. And I got reading in metaphysic books that I could. Some I understood and some I didn't. I did a lot of things. But the thing that helped me the most in my whole life, I discovered when I was a boy, just before my 16th birthday, on the deck of a ship in Pearl Harbor, early in the Second World War, where I'd run away, not out of patriotism, I ran away because I couldn't stand to be in Eau Claire, Wisconsin with a stepmother and stepfather I hated. And I ran away, and on the deck of a ship, some men intimidated me into drinking whiskey. I promised my mother and grandmother I wouldn't drink whiskey, but I was more eager to impress them than I was to be true to my mother and grandmother. And I drank some whiskey and it made me sick and I threw it up. But a few days later, I finally held a drink of alcohol down. It burned my throat, burned my stomach. But I noticed it almost instantly made me feel significantly better. You know, when you're growing up, despite all we say, you learn most of life in your teens. That's where you learn life. You learn about sex, and you learn about drinking, and you learn about working, and you learn about your family won't support you forever. You learn about human relationships. You learn about being out of your house. And you try to keep the things you like and get rid of the things you don't like. And alcohol was no big thing to me. It was just a thing that made me feel good a lot, better than anything I knew. And I'd become a terrible old drunk, staggering around. I got drunk sometimes with men and made me sick, but it made me feel like a man. And I, at the end of the war, I was in a naval hospital, that's Pleasant in California, and being sewed together, and somebody came around and passed out, the gray ladies passed out tests. I've always been good on tests. I'm so glad they did that. So I cracked this test, and they gave me a high school equivalency. I sometimes think, I don't know what would have happened to me if I had to go back to be a junior in high school after the war. But I went to college instead, and I got married in college out in the world, and I became a sports writer. And I got into advertising and public relations and became somewhat successful from time to time. And all of this time, alcohol was a great help to me. I think it's safe to say that alcohol is the best friend I have ever had. That sounds terrible to say that in an AA meeting, I know that. But it still bothers me when I hear some old fool get up and say something like, "That damn alcohol was poison from the first drink." It's like hearing somebody badmouth an old girlfriend of mine, you know. "Hey, wait a minute. She may be a pig now, but she didn't used to be." You know. But alcohol, I just loved it. The only problem I ever had with alcohol, alcohol took a person who didn't feel like they're quite enough and almost instantly made me feel like something more than enough. It took a person who lived with fear and made me feel without fear. It took a person who lived with a lot of pain and made me without pain. Alcohol was a great thing. To this day, I'm telling you, if you be like me, a few drinks will make you feel better than a year of psychoanalysis. A few drinks will make you feel better than the complete understanding of the Nietzschean philosophy of the Übermensch. A few drinks is good. The only problem I've ever had, I have a tendency sometimes to drink a little too much. And sometimes I get a little bizarre. And I worked out the reason for that, too. You can't take a child and repress them like a spring and keep them in that position. Then you give them alcohol that releases their bindings. And certainly they're going to spring up a little bit. But I never could convince the police of that theory. "Oh, shut up and get in the car." And so a lot of people thought I had some kind of a little problem with drinking, although I never did. I have much deeper problems than that. But I was sent to my first AA meeting in 1949. That's a long time ago. A lot of little snots here weren't even born in 1949. We love you. I was 22. It doesn't seem terribly young now, but then nobody had heard of anybody within 15 years of 22. And they just thought I was a little dumb little jerk, and I thought they were stupid old dumbbells. Today, there's a lot of young people. Something I like to say every time I talk these days, because I think we neglect to say it. They're playing our song. Anyway. There's a lot of young people in AA now, and we sometimes forget to tell them this. I think we ought to stop them. Like in my group, my home group in L.A., some of you have been there, enormous group, 1,200 people every Wednesday night, all up, all goers. It really is exciting. We have a lot of young people. There's a lot of young people here. And if you young people in this hall are like the young people in our group, I want you to remember, you are the AA leaders of tomorrow. And if you're like the young people in our group, I want to tell you, I'm really glad I'm going to be dead. Nothing personal, but my sponsor told me 30 years ago, he told me that same thing, and he's glad he's dead. So that shows you. But I went to AA and it's dreary. It doesn't take long to be in AA. We have new people here. If you've been here at your third meeting, you know about AA. is a place where people with alcohol problems come and they sober up and clean up their act, and gradually they get better and they live happily ever after. And I tried it, but my problems turned out to be much more complex than could be solved by stopping drinking and cleaning up my act. And little by little got worse, so I couldn't stand it. And I needed some relief. And so after that, I started going into other therapies. From time to time, I went to AA year after year because people always think I had a drinking problem and I could get the heat off momentarily. But it had no meaningful effect on me. And some years later, through a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings, something happened to me that cannot happen to a person with my background and intelligence and success. I found myself being physically thrown out of a Skid Row mission. And the guy told me not to come back. And I tried to explain to him, I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Some ads that I helped write with some other guys, the old Elsie and Elmer ads for the Borden Company, they were running that very week in Life and Time and Collier's, the Zurgin Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for achievement. How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times for achievement? But it's very hard to explain these things in midair. And I'd had my front teeth kicked out shortly before that, so I wasn't hitting those consonants quite as cleanly as I would have liked. But I stood outside of a Skid Row mission, and if a guy came up to me and said, hey, your life depends on the answer, Spud, you an alcoholic? I'd have had to say, no, I'm not, really. But I wish I were. I wish my life were that simple. And it rained. I finally walked 71 blocks out to the corner of Wilshire and Fairfax, where there's a little club that I'd been asked to leave a while back for fighting a couple weeks before. And I hung around that damn club. There was a guy who was bright lawyer type who was in and out of that club from time to time. I stayed sober longer than even he did because he was such a loser. He's your speaker tomorrow night. That's the kind of judges you have in California. But anyway, I hung around there. God, it was a terrible place because they were a nest of AA fanatics. There's nothing worse when you're a slipper than to fall into the hands of AA fanatics. We're going to do a lot of media. We're going to work this up. You know. And they did the same thing as they do now.
Get a sponsor. Get a sponsor.
So I got a sponsor, a guy named Bob B. And he was an actor I'd seen in movies and character roles. He always played a loving, kindly uncle or something. So I thought he'd be nice. And he turned out to be just... Those roles he played, he should have won the Academy Award for him. He's just crazy. He's just power drunk dictator, intimidating old fool. So I stayed away from him as long as much as I could because he had no concept of, you know, about intelligence. I was living in the back seat of an abandoned car back at the AA club at that time, off and on. And I tried to explain to him, hey, Bob, I know you mean well by having me take these actions, you think, but I'm not one of these guys who just knew an AA. I've been AA in and out for years, Bob. In my judgment, I need something much more intense than AA. It's a nice place for people drinking, but Bob, in my judgment, Bob, there's something I need much more. And he would explain the answer and say, in your judgment? Who cares about your goddamn judgment? You live in an abandoned car. And I'll think later, what kind of answer is that? Unnecessary cruelty. You'd have me do things Friday night. There's a coffee cup discussion meeting. You know, say, why don't you stay after the meeting and pick up cups? And that, can you imagine what demeaning I would fondle a cup till he left and I'd be at the other door. I mean, I'm down and out and now I'm being, my intellectual integrity is going too. God, I've got much left, but let me save something.
And he's always having me do stupid things, and I hated him. I stayed out of his sight, and a couple of times I was going to resign him as a sponsor. I'd say, Bob?
Yeah?
Oh, nothing. I hate to be intimidated. I'm going to tell you something. I always, when I talk about him, I always quote him using that kind of language. I think it should. I should say, because I thought about this about a month ago. He never talked like that. That's just the way I heard it. He would say things, no. But I heard it. I've given him a bad call for 30-some years, and I really shouldn't. He talked with subdued intensity. But I'll tell you, I'd about had enough. I stayed sober, and I hung around with Don, and I remember an old guy named Bill Lerner who used to be around, who was the heir to the Lerner shops. I tried to move in on him, and his sponsor warned him off. And there was a lot of people around. A guy named Jim McCoy took me on his sofa, and I got mad at him because one night after 2 weeks there, his girlfriend came over in the middle of the night, and they wanted me to get up and walk the streets. And, well, they chatted, I guess. And I said, why don't you have her walk the streets? She's more used to it. And I was back in the abandoned car. Just a series of bad breaks. I often think, what's the turning spot? What is the turning spot in my life? And it's always struck me, didn't strike me until a couple of years ago. Really, I had other turning spots. When I was about 5 months sober, as I recall it, especially I remember, one night I was at the Central Hollywood group. That was a particularly dreadful group that met at the women's club on North La Brea. And really misfits and terrible. And they had, some of the people had spiked hair. You know, doesn't sound so bad, but in 1959, nobody really had spiked hair. And they wore funny clothes. And one guy, I remember, had little elf boots that curled up at the end. And Jesus. That was a meeting that I understand that Bela Lugosi used to go to from time to time when he was coming off drugs. Just, you know. Get away from me, you vampire some bitch. But I fit right in there for some reason. And it was a coffee break, like we have in meetings. And I was at this meeting because it was all participation. I'd like to go to participation meetings. And because I like to participate. I don't want to hear these crappy speakers and their long success stories. Oh, I'm wonderful. And oh, screw it. You know. And I never could seem to get called on much at these participation meetings. Very rarely. Years later, I found out why. Because when they'd call on me, I'd get up and tell them what a bunch of crap AA was. It never struck me that it would offend them. I thought I was trying to teach them. But so I was standing at the coffee break and waiting for the leader to get back so I could suggest my name to call on. And I noticed about the second row, there was a woman, her name was like Mary Lisa maybe, I guess. But she was there's one of those in every group in the world, I'm sure. About 3 years sober and just getting along fine and sponsoring new girls. And helping people. And people say, here's our beloved Mary Lisa. And let's have her be our secretary. It isn't that she gets called on all the time. And the kind of person you just want to go, ooh, 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 you know. And I was standing there thinking, I really wasn't giving a serious thought, but I kind of thought it would be kind of, I don't know what people would say if I just went over there and said, hey, Mary Lisa, take a bow. And just then, here comes my sponsor through the crowd, followed by two of his brown nosers. He says, Clancy! He says, I want you to apologize to Mary Lisa. I thought, my God, he can read my mind. He's the warlock. Maybe we'll have to burn him at the stake. I said, why? He said, someone told me That's something else you might think about. If you're going to get a sponsor, get one without snitches. Because if they got snitches, you're just screwed. There's never any rest. You never knew to watch for. He said, someone told me that last night at the Frank Randall group, you called her a bitch. I said, well, Bob, I hope you understand this and won't take it badly, but she really is a bitch. Well, why do you think she's a bitch? She told her new girl not to go to bed with me. Well, she was absolutely right. You go and apologize. And the worst part of it is, she can hear all this. And she's standing there. Oh, God. And I decided to leave AA. I've had all I can take. I don't mind being, it's bad enough being done, but being publicly humiliated is the worst thing can happen to people that I know who are insecure. And I used to be a good writer once upon a time, and I was in my mind's eye putting together my resignation. I was going to get it really fine and just turn it and give it to that old crazed bastard. I had it worked out kind of like, Bob, why didn't you take these 12 golden steps of recovery, lard them with the 12 traditions which are the group as the steps are the individual, season them with the 12 concepts of world service, wrap them all in the 12 promises which never come true to anyone with any intelligence, and stick them up your nose, because I've had all I'm going to take. And I was just about to lay this out of him. It would have destroyed him, I know it, but he deserved it. And suddenly, a light came out of heaven and illuminated me. Actually, it was just a passing thought, but it's a little more dramatic that way. It suddenly struck me, God, I've been doing this all wrong. Yeah. You may have noticed I don't have much hair in front. I spent a lifetime doing that. Oh, I'm wrong again. Huh? Oh, you're pregnant again. How nice. But it suddenly struck me. You know, I'm doing this all wrong. I'm acting as though I got to be some sort of a person who means this crap. I don't have to mean it. They're crazy. I can play their sick game and ridicule them while I do it. I just have to do it. And while I can do it and ridicule him and all of them. And that idiot will think I mean it. I'll put him down. Okay, Bob.
Lisa.
You bitch. I became something of an activist after that. Be at the Friday night coffee cup discussion meeting. Bob said, pick up the cups. Sure, Bob. And I'd think, you know why you can't get any roles in movies? Because you're ugly and you're crazy. I put that guy down. So I used to feel sorry for him sometimes. I'm a master of vilification, I'll tell you. And I really felt sorry for him. I started to get better somehow. Not really better, but I survived. And a month later, when I lost my job as a dishwasher at the Gaiety Delicatessen after 3 days, because I thought the busboys were getting dishes from other restaurants to humiliate me. But that's a different story. Instead of killing myself, I found myself calling my sponsor because those few actions had got me to do that. And he cursed me into writing an inventory that I swore I'd never write because I've taken my inventory with the psychiatrist. Why would I take it with an out-of-work actor? That made him testy when I told him that, too. But I eventually took an inventory, and a week later, we went along the ocean, and with my at night with a flashlight in my hand and the papers, and I read this hideous thing to him. And I made that same trip over 200 times since then, with me on the driver's side, listening to some other boob over there rattle our papers and hoping your battery will go dead. You always know it's a good inventory when you hear the words, let me explain this part. But they're really all kind of similar after a while. You can really, when they start off, you know where they're going almost. You know, you can almost say, didn't you leave something out there? You've been talking to that bitch? But I wrote an inventory. I took a fifth step, much to my surprise. And a couple months later, one day when I was feeling terrible, my sponsor made me write a letter to my father. And on and on. And little by little, it's gone on. I've survived. I've always stayed a strong believer in the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a lot of philosophers here, but the action people are the ones who are involved. I'll tell you, I travel around the country a lot, and in this country, and all countries in the world, I've been around many countries in the world where there's AA and talk to meetings. In every place, there are always pockets of enthusiasm, surrounded by kind of apathetic areas, then another pocket of enthusiasm, and so on. And every time you find a pocket of enthusiasm, you will find a group that has a strong sponsorship ethic. Because strong sponsorship gets people doing things that they would never do unless they were required to do it. And the more you do, the more you get involved, and the better you feel. Didn't mean to offend you by talking about action. I always hurt somebody's feelings. I don't mean to. But I finally held a job when I was a year sober. 2 years sober, I got a little job in a medical corporation. And little by little, got better. Got to be director of advertising for that medical corporation. And I worked for this toy factory and did well. And then another guy and I were brought into Hollywood, and we created the number one hard rock station in the world, something called Boss Radio. And we all wore shiny suits and said things like, "What's coming on down, baby?" Ten-year sober as Don Republic released the oil companies. 15 years sober as a marketing director in Beverly Hills. Then in some hideous fit of something or other, I left there, and for the last 18 years, I've run the mission on Skid Row that threw me out in 1958. And people say, "Why would you want to do that?" And I explained to them. I told that guy when he threw me out, "I'll come back and get you someday. And once I find him, I'm out of there." Now, it's interesting. I'll tell you, it's an interesting thing. I was in pre-law once in college, and I sometimes when I see Don has been moved to a building just 2 blocks from our mission. And he can look out his window and see my mission on Skid Row, and I can look out my window and see the ivory towers of the Reagan office building up there. And I think to myself, just quirk of fate, how can I be grateful? And I found something to be grateful for. Every time he looks out the window, he sees filth and degradation. Skid Row. When I look out the window, I see the Reagan office building. I'm so glad I didn't become a lawyer. There's a lot of parables, morals here. I don't know what they are. But it's a funny thing. Don came over to the mission. He showed me around the Supreme Court of California. So we have a working relationship 2 blocks apart. Small world. So now, when I was 5 years sober, the same wife and all those children jumped out of a post office box in Dallas. They moved to Los Angeles. Another Catholic hit the street 9 months and 10 seconds later. I finally was able to get into that rhythm system. And it really is nice now. I was talking to someone about this at dinner. It's a funny thing. I've talked about it before. But when I was a boy in World War II, young boy, they used to on these ships, they used to give us a lot of saltpeter in our food. I don't know if you know what saltpeter is. It's a sexual depressant. And they give it to you on ships because so you'd be out there in the middle of the ocean, you wouldn't be eyeing the messmen or something, you know. You doing anything after dishes, wand, you know. It made you feel less, supposed to be less irritable and cross. But it never seemed to work. I must have eaten tons of that stuff. I was always nervous and irritable and cross and thinking of fantasizing about girls all the time. That's the funny thing about the damn saltpeter. It just kicked in about 2 years ago. Now when I don't need it, well, but... But I'd say, and so now I'm at the stage, and I'm doing well. I live in the ocean. I'm doing well. My kids have all grown up, done well. My oldest daughter was recently named Assistant Attorney General for the state of New Mexico. She was the oldest and went through the most hell as a child. She's doing fine, and her daughter's doing fine. In fact, her daughter is graduating this year from University of New Mexico. About a year ago, she was home at Christmas, and she and I get along well. I'll tell you some information. You may have noticed grandchildren and grandparents always get along well. And you may not know why. No other meeting in the world tonight will have this information. You have come to the right meeting. Grandchildren and grandparents get along well because they share a common enemy. And don't you forget it. But my granddaughter said she was going to start a thing on her campus, the first one ever, children of adult children of alcoholics. And I said, why in the world are we going to start that? She said, just like the name, Kaka. Well, I sent her to her room. And incidentally, her mother told me something when she became Assistant Attorney General. She said, Dad, remember when I was little, you used to send me to my room all the time? I said, yes, you really need it, honey. She said, I probably did, but when you come to New Mexico, I've got a little room to send you now. I know she's kidding, but I just haven't been in New Mexico. But it's a nice thing. Now, there's only kind of one thing left. Is there anyone here in the first 30 days? Raise your hand. I need somebody in their first 30 days. You're in your first 30 days? Good. Because this is the stage of a talk that old-timers need newcomers to look at. You don't really say this, but you talk about how successful you become. And now you look at the newcomer as if to say, I've got it all together, and you haven't. And maybe never will have. You don't really say it, but you have to look at him and tell him that. But there's one little thing I want to talk to the newcomer about, the privilege you get out of getting that sort of crap from the speaker. Because you'll get it a lot, because every time you go to a meeting, I was down and out, now I'm wonderful. I was down and out, now I'm wonderful. You know? I just feel grand. Makes you wish you had a curare dart. Tell us how that feels, you old sumbitch, you know. I want to say just for 5 or 6, 7 minutes maybe, I want to talk about something else. The most important thing I've said tonight, or I'll say before I sit down, I said a long time ago, and nobody paid any attention to me, nor should you. I said, my name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. Now, how in the world could I be an alcoholic? Alcohol was not my number one problem when I drank. Alcohol was not my number one problem when I got sober. And alcohol has sure as hell hasn't been my number one problem since. So how can I be an alcoholic? I'm glad that I survived here long enough. I'm glad that I fell into the hands of activists. I'm glad I've always been in the front lines. I haven't been mature enough to withdraw from AA, perhaps. I'm glad that I've always been involved, So I've been able to understand the most, come to eventually learn, the most important single thing I have ever learned about my life and what I could do about it. And if you're new tonight or have weak and heavy laden, perhaps, because you get weak and heavy laden almost any time along the way sometimes, I want to tell you something that I think, if you hear nothing else I say, everything I've said so far is introduction to this sentence. I'm glad that I survived long enough to discover that if my problem is alcohol, I am not an alcoholic. And conversely, if I'm an alcoholic, my problem is not and cannot be alcohol. Now, doesn't that sound upside down in some crazy TV guru style answer? But I'm convinced that's the message of AA. I'm convinced that's what we're all here about. I'm convinced that's the message of this book. I'm sure I'm one of the very few people in this room who ever sat and talked to Bill Wilson about it. That's what he felt in 1963. I don't think he changed his mind after that. But you say, of course the problem is alcohol. What kind of talk is it? Some kind of crappiness. I can disprove that in 10 seconds. If the problem is alcohol, detoxes turn out recovered people. And they don't. Hospitals turn out recovered people. Treatment facilities turn out recovered people. Jails turn out recovered people. They turn out people who have been detoxified and are sober physically with varying amounts of information of what might be wrong with them. But I'll guarantee you, if they be like me, and I presume like you since you're here, unless something dramatic happens after that, they will always eventually begin to drink or take sedating and tranquilizing medications. Always. Well, why? What's the problem then if it isn't alcohol? What is it? Are the old timers keeping a secret from us? No. It's something you talk about at every meeting you go to. You read about in this book. We hear it all the time. But if you are like me, your preconception of the word may be strong enough to blot out the meaning of it. The problem we are here to deal with is not alcohol. It is something called alcoholism. Is it? Same thing, alcohol, alcoholism, matter of semantics. Not a matter of semantics. I'll guarantee you, if you be like me, the day will come when your life and sanity will depend on remembering the difference. What is the difference? A lot of differences. We're kind of late. I want to get to our ice cream. Put it in one sentence. They've already taken it out and it's melting in the dishes. I can put it in one sentence. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking and cleaning up your act. In this strange, denigrating, destructive, emotionally eroding, fatal thing called alcoholism, you will discover sooner or later, if you haven't discovered it yet, that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. That's what makes alcoholism a fatal disease, because sobriety, the pain of sobriety eventually always becomes worse than the memory of the pain of drinking. But even that doesn't make you an alcoholic. That just prepares you to be an alcoholic. That's just some kind of an obsession of the mind. There's got to be something else. And that's something most of us never knew either. They talk, you go to Amy's, they talk about the allergy of the body. What the hell does that mean? Even when he wrote it, Bill Wilson wasn't quite sure what he was talking about. Later on, another doctor said, call it a sensitivity. What the hell does that mean? Put it this way. In every generation, as far back as people have can find, and sometimes back to biblical times, a certain percentage, it seems now to be 5 or 6 or 7%, of people who drink alcohol get an unnatural reaction to alcohol. They don't know it's an unnatural reaction, and the people around them don't know they're not getting it. But they get an unnatural reaction to alcohol, and nobody knows why. So the problem gets to be, what is this unnatural reaction? Let's find that out, and then we can know what to do. Okay? what is this unnatural reaction? Well, you go to a meeting, you hear a guy say, I drank and stayed drunk around the clock for 20 years. You think, that's it, you stay drunk. But that's not true. Despite how people remember their lives, it is physically impossible to stay intoxicated 14 straight days and nights in a laboratory. Your body will always stop the induction of alcohol. Well, maybe you can't handle it. False. Any number of tests indicate alcoholics handle a given amount of alcohol better than social drinkers in any kind of a test. I don't know if you've ever been to a party where alcoholics and non-alcoholics drank the same amount. But if you have, I'll guarantee you, you'll see the alcoholics drive the non-alcoholics home. But it's hard to make the test because you can't get the non-alcoholics to drink that much. They say things like, oh, no more for me, I'm starting to feel it. And the answer to that is, why don't you feel this, wussy? Yeah. Is it that it makes you crazy? Makes you crazy? Maybe. You hear all these speakers, famous speakers. Then I escaped from the penitentiary, raped 7 nuns, went to the state insane asylum. Things were taking a turn for the worse. That isn't it. I'm sure, unlike everyone here, I don't know, maybe there's someone here that does this, I don't think so. In the morning, when I go to work, as I did yesterday morning and will Monday, when I get out of my car, I have to step over the bodies of men and women dying from alcoholism to get to my office. When I leave my office at night, I step over the bodies of dying men and women to get to my car. You'd think it'd be just terminally hideous and horrible. But it's like everything else. Nothing is horrible or nothing is wonderful after you're used to it. It just becomes a condition. But I see these alcoholics die. I mean literally die, not they're getting sick. And many of them have never acted bizarrely once. They get just the opposite. They get more and more catatonic. You almost have to hold a mirror up to their mouth to see if they're still breathing. That's not it. Isn't acting bizarre. Then what the hell is it? What is this elusive allergy of the body, unnatural reaction? What the hell is it? It turns out to my satisfaction, it turns out. Yeah. Don't you know I'm a celebrity speaker? They'll all come out from the washroom and their faces will be flushed. What is this unnatural thing? Of all things, I never would have guessed this in 10,000 years on my own. Alcohol must have the unnatural ability to almost instantly make everything all right. That's all. It's hard to realize it doesn't do that for most people. As my sponsor used to point out to me, to them, alcohol goes blah, blah, blah. To you and me, it goes boom. That's why we're in this meeting and they're not. I see that, yeah. Means nothing. But to this day, I want to drop this in. Because I was speaking a couple weeks ago tonight, 3 weeks ago tonight, somewhere in a meeting, and it suddenly struck me. That night, I had been sober exactly a third of a century. 33 years and 4 months doesn't sound like much, but a third of a century, that has a ring to it. You know. Looking back over the past third of a century, but I don't know of a better test for alcoholism. If you're wondering if you're an alcoholic, still the best test I've ever heard. You can take the 20 questions, you can take the 40 questions, and you can write away to Ann Landers. But the best test is always this, to me. When your back's to the wall and the hounds of fate are ripping at your throat, you say, give me a drink. Would you be satisfied to have it go? Or are you like me and most of us, when your back's to the wall and the hounds of fate are ripping at your throat, give me a drink, and it doesn't go, it goes. You want to try me, Copper? You know that job I worked for 6 months to get, Mr. Carlson? Shove it. You with anyone, Granny? Alcohol must have the unnatural ability to almost instantly alter my perception of reality. It must almost instantly change my relationship to my environment. It must almost instantly make me taller and more self-contained, and them smaller and less frightening. And what's wrong with it? It's great. It works better than any narcotic I know of. I've been working with narcotics addicts for over 25 years. I know a little bit about narcotics. Heroin gets you into this wonderful feeling, but you can't ever get back to it after a short time. Heroin addicts always die from overdoses because they're trying to get back to that feeling. Cocaine addicts get up there and suddenly discover they are hooked on this terrible thing. And when the paranoia comes and all the things that come along with it, they're just screwed. But alcohol puts you right where you are, feeling something more than enough without fear. Momentary omnipotence. And the only problem is, if it does that for you, it little by little erodes what abilities you have to deal with the conflicts of reality. Most people have to work through these problems. I can change them. And eventually drinking gets to be a problem, as you must with everything you depend on. So you stay sober. And you realize it's really painful. And drinking was not the problem. These are real problems. So eventually you drink. And you drink till you have to get sober. And you stay sober, you have to drink. And that phenomenon is called alcoholism. And today in America, with all the treatment facilities and Alcoholics Anonymous having more sober people in the history of the world, it is estimated over 90% of alcoholics in America still die drunk, or as a direct result of drinking. And I'll tell you this, they die with the same thought, nearly all of them die with the same thought on their lips. But I'm not really an alcoholic. You don't understand. My problems came when I was sober. They were real. I just drank to get some relief. And they don't realize they've just defined the disease of alcoholism. Sobriety is the curse, and alcohol becomes the curse. And it has nothing to do with it. I'm on Skid Row. You say, well, it's on Skid Row. But I've had the opportunity to sponsor people who are still making $100,000 when they're at their bottom. And I've sponsored movie stars and psychiatrists and priests and doctors and ditch diggers and guys who never hold a job. What do they share? They share an unnatural reaction to alcohol coupled with an unnatural pain of reality. And the reason that's important to understand new people, so you will not think that you can come here and get sober and clean up your act and it'll get better. It will for a little while, but eventually it'll get worse. The natural state of sober alcoholics is growing discontent, depression, anxiety. Till finally the day comes, some doctors say that the day comes when you must drink to preserve your sanity. Now, the reason that's important to know is that we will remember that coming to AA is not the answer. Cleaning up your act is not the answer. It's like, I think we've been having a lot of rains in Los Angeles recently. I know you read about them. But a lot of people don't see rain much. They don't know how to act in rain. But you see people, it's like jumping on somebody's porch when it's raining, then to let us up a little bit and make a walk. And that's what, I'm sure there are 10 times as many people on the streets who used to be in AA as are in AA right now. I don't know anybody, long-term drinker, who hasn't been in AA somewhere along the line. And the one problem is always this. They are convinced. I tried AA and it didn't work. I tried it 15 years ago. And I stayed sober and it didn't work. They've been caught in the rainstorm and they've jumped on the porch. And when it let up, away they go. And they never stayed here long enough to discover what you and I must continually reinforce ourselves and those we work with. That we're on the porch of a large, frightening house. And against every one of my inclinations, once I get dried off, I got to go into that house. And it's fearful. And it's fearful inside of it. People like me, and I presume like you, who've always had problems with human relationships, they tell me I should get involved in human relationships. People like me, who've always felt hurt a lot, who have never wanted to extend myself. I have to extend myself. People like me who've spent my life perfecting my defense so people could not see my inadequacies and my dirtiness. They want me to volunteer my inadequacies and my dirtiness. A person like me who all my life I would like to find someone who could help me, but nobody really understands. And this guy, he means well, but he can't possibly understand how I feel. But they want me to ask him to be my sponsor and let him know that he'll tell me what to do and I'll do it, even though he can't possibly understand the problem. And you got to do that. And over a period of time, you got to take 12 steps that at the time seem to have no application to any deep-seated problem. You bet it's frightening in that damn house. But the point is, hopefully, one of the great things that help you, the more desperate you are, it gets a little easier. So desperation, you may think, is a terrible curse, but it's a great help to you here. But the point of AA is what? If you do all these things, will you become a saint? No. Will you become a holy person? No. Will you get the love of your dreams? Maybe, maybe not. Has nothing to do with it. AA, it turns out, I'm convinced, will do something that I would have bet my life could not be done. It very slowly does what alcohol does fast. That's all. Only very slowly. It takes a person who is not enough, and most of the time I feel like I'm enough. It takes a person who's lived with fear all my life, and most of the time I live without fear. It takes a person who has always felt vulnerable and put upon, and most of the time I feel invulnerable and not put upon. And what a great gift, but it comes so slowly it's hard to remember it. That's why we have to keep getting together to reinforce one another, to help us remember what we are. And then we got to keep doing it and passing it along. One of the great lines of all time is Dr. Bob's last talk. He said, none of us would be here if somebody hadn't given us a pat on the back, and we better take time to give the man behind us a pat on the back too. We must take the actions of AA. To this day, action is the magic word. It is easy to get rid of these problems by becoming a victim, but it may cost you your life. It is better to work on them with actions and pay as you go and get rid of the damn things and not have a tab. So it's a great feeling to remember when I was at the Texas Insane Asylum some years ago on a bum charge. I thought I was a schizophrenic and I didn't want to tell them. I had many personalities for that. But I went to an AA meeting there and it was just hideous. I don't know if you've ever been to an AA meeting in Texas. They do it in some other parts of the South, but in Texas they do it all the time. Some boob, you know, we get up and say, my name is Clancy, but I'm an alcoholic. I'm just, hi, Clancy. But in Texas they get up and say, my name is Fred, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and the power of this simple program, it's not been necessary for me to drink any alcohol or take any mind-sedating or tranquilizing medications since my sobriety day. And for this, I'm truly grateful. Then they say, ah, Fred. And when you're just coming off shock treatment, you know, ah. And I remember thinking, if I ever get to a position of prominence where I could get up and talk, I wouldn't give them that kind of a chant. I tell them the facts. So I've been flown here tonight at tremendous expense and no little inconvenience, hopefully trying to get this conference off on the right foot. So I want to give you the inside shot. If you're new tonight, or we can have you laden or otherwise. I'll tell you what I found in AA. The real stuff. I discovered, as I said, that I was an alcoholic. After some time, I discovered alcoholism. So I could honestly say, my name is Clancy Imeslin, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and the power of the simple program, it's not been necessary for me to drink any alcohol or take any mind-sedating or tranquilizing medications since October 31st, 1958. And for this, I am truly grateful. Thank you.